Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. We're actually branching out a little on this week's episode, because we normally stick to the classic era, but I thought that one thing that's always been fascinating, or one thing I've always found fascinating, are films about the classic era, contemporary films about the classic era, or contemporary films about classic stars. So today we're going to take a look at 2018's Stan and Ollie, about Laurel and Hardy, of course, in the twilight of their career. A film starring Steve Coogan as Stan Laurel and John C. Reilly as Oliver Hardy, directed by John S. Baird. And I'm delighted to welcome Raquel Stetcher back onto the podcast today. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Glad you could join me to help me test out this, you know, this different type of episode. I feel like, you know, it's another nice mess I've gotten you into. But yeah, thank you.
I'm excited for the opportunity. This is going to be a great subject to talk about.
Yeah, because we're going to talk not just about Stan and Ollie, but a little bit about Laurel and Hardy and just about this type of film in general, I suppose. So yeah, films about classic Hollywood or classic movies, classic movie stars. What do you think the appeal of these stories is, whether it's, you know, to you specifically, or what do you think maybe for audiences generally? What's so good about them?
I think the movie industry loves to make biopics and loves to make biopics about themselves. I think that's where it first originates. Biopics, it's a known brand. Whoever the subject is, chances are people are going to know who they are. They're going to, even if they don't ask for the biopic, which, to be honest, hardly any of us want a biopic about our favorite people. It's not something we ever crave or wish would happen. But once it comes out in theaters, we're like, oh, I'll try that out. I like this person. I'll go check out a biopic about them. But what I think what's the appeal to the movie industry is that they know there's a built-in audience. So they'll get a return on their investment. They'll know they'll get butts in seats. They'll get the fan base to the theater. Plus, especially when it's a biopic about old Hollywood, they can go all out with the production quality, with the, you know, the period costumes and the cars, the vintage cars, the beautiful sets. They can really play around with color. They can play around with imagery and really have a lot of fun. It's a quite of a creative thing. And we, as the audience, eat that stuff up. I know I love watching period films and just reveling in all those small details, even down to like what, you know, the telephone on the desk or the clock in the background. Those little details are so great. So I feel like even though with biopics, we don't necessarily ask for them, or even the old Hollywood ones, anything about old Hollywood, we don't really crave those. But once they're out there, it'll draw classic movie fans.
Yeah, and sometimes you hear a bit of like trepidation, don't you? Like,
yes.
Oh man, I hope they don't get this wrong, that kind of thing. Yeah, I really agree with what you say, I think. But yeah, you just get these larger than life figures, don't you, from old movies, and you can see where the drama can come in because it's such a dog eat dog like industry. But also broader themes, you know, it kind of ties into the idea of like the American dream, I guess, like in more than one way, because you can get great success stories from Hollywood that you see in these movies sometimes. But also, you know, failures of the American dream, which can be fascinating, too. And I guess we kind of get a bit of that in Stan and Ollie, not to jump ahead, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, I mean, as you said, like this has got a well of stories that they could just draw from for sure. And then all those old Hollywood scandals. I mean, there's so many. It pretty much almost destroyed the industry at one point, especially in the 20s. And one of the reasons we had the production code was because of how much people were trying to get away with at that time. So if you think about it, there's a lot of like titillating stories that are perfect for movies.
Yeah, and like we say, there can be this trepidation or fear, you know, reluctance to see some of these stories brought to the screen. And they can be a very tricky thing to put up on screen too, I think. So, yeah, I think there's a few. Well, what do you think some of the main pitfalls that filmmakers can kind of fall into when depicting this world of like classic Hollywood, classic movies?
The thing is, truth is stranger than fiction. So these stories are already interesting, but real life doesn't fit in the mold of a 1.5 hour or 2 hour movie. So the filmmakers have to take creative, like artistic license, basically. They have to shift timelines. Sometimes characters are invented. Sometimes multiple characters are combined into one for brevity. drama is added. Sometimes there are aspects of a person's life that is an unknown or a mystery. So they try to explore that and maybe give a possibility of what might have happened. It's almost a guarantee when you have a biopic that it's not going to be completely accurate. But when you have the fan base who, especially for us, if for any of us who are really big fans of the subject in the biopic, we're going to be very picky and we're going to know that there's going to be some inconsistencies, but it's all a matter of how they're treated. And in some cases, it just ruins the movie. In other cases, okay, we'll let that slide. But what worries me about biopics is for the people who are not familiar with the subject, that they might take the whole film as fact. Mm. And they might not know what is real and what's not. So it really depends on how the filmmakers approach the end result.
Yeah, I really think that, like you mentioned about, you know, fans of classic movies, and, you know, I think it seems to me that, you know, classic movie fans are incredibly passionate, very knowledgeable.
Yes.
And if biopics don't really get it right, fans can often be merciless, I think, as a result. So whether it's to do with performance or factual errors or misrepresentation or whatever it may be, and I think you see that with things like Mummy Dearest, the Joan Crawford film, where it seems to me like the strongest negative reactions about that film I've ever seen have been from really big Joan Crawford fans. So that's going to be really interesting when there's that film Judy coming out in a few months, isn't there, about Judy Garland late this year. And she's another star with very devoted fans. And it's just going to be an interesting kind of test case for that, I think. Yeah.
And with the biopics, it skirts the line between, okay, artistic license and expression and libel. I mean, just to take, for example, the TV show Feud and how Olivia de Havilland had an issue with how she was represented in that film. And she took it to court and it just didn't pan out because the creative license kind of wins over that, because this is, while it is based on truth, it's also in many ways fiction.
Yeah, and that's something we'll talk about in conjunction with Stan and Ollie, I think. But it hits at like the big question, I think, for filmmakers is like, what story do you want to tell? Mm-hmm. Do you want to do a cradle to grave story? Do you want to do something that spans somebody's working life? Do you want to zero in on a more limited period of time, which is what they do in Stan and Ollie, I think. And all those approaches have their merits. I think I generally favour the latter, I think. I think that lends itself better to a feature film format. And it seems to be the sort of modern trend as well. But I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as you said, cradle to grave, that is an approach. But I don't know if that is necessary unless the origin story of maybe how that person was raised was super interesting. But really the focus on the career, especially for somebody who's an artist, like an actor or an actress, that the career to me is what's most interesting. Mm. So yeah, if it focuses on that more so than the personal life, I'm more drawn to it.
Yeah, and we're going to discuss a few good examples of this type of film. But I guess one of the other challenges is, obviously, when you have a story about like these immortal film stars or about a very famous director or something, you kind of have to cast a contemporary actor to fill these big shoes. And it's just a huge call, I think. And I suppose the question is, do you go for somebody who can match the character they're playing for star appeal, in which case they may not disappear into the role exactly? Or do you go for somebody who can embody the character they're playing convincingly, but maybe doesn't have the same kind of marquee value? And I don't know, what do we want as audiences? Do we want to see somebody doing an impersonation, or do we want to see kind of an interpretation?
Yeah, that depends on the audience member. Some people would, oh, I want this person to look exactly like the subject of the movie. Or they just want that person to do justice to the role and capture the essence of the person. And maybe we'll be a little more lenient with some of the things that don't quite match, but as long as they kind of got the spirit of the character. So it depends.
Yeah, and with all that said then, so what do you think are a few good examples of this type of film? So I'll chip in a couple as well, but I know there are a few you wanted to highlight. Yeah, so what would you say?
So one film that came out a few years ago, Trumbo from 2015, that was super interesting. Dalton Trumbo, who is the subject of the film, played by Bryan Cranston. Dalton Trumbo is an incredibly important figure in my life. His writings have basically changed my life in many respects. So I never wanted a Trumbo biopic, but I got one. So I, as soon as I heard that that was, I was like, well, I have to go watch that, even if I didn't ask for it. So I did go see it, and I thought it was a great film. I thought Bryan Cranston did a great job as Trumbo. And one thing I really appreciated about it is that it focuses on the Blacklist era and how he was caught up in that and how he became a victim of that. And I think it's very important in terms of history for us never to forget that mm-hmm. era, because it had done so much damage to so many lives. And we, you know, as they say, history, you know, can repeat itself if we don't know it, you know, if we don't know yeah. our history. So I think that in that respect was really important. My biggest issue with the film, though, is the portrayal of Edward G. Robinson, whose storyline they twisted to make him out as a villain. So there was some artistic license that they took. They made him seem like he named names when he really didn't. So anyone who doesn't know Edward G. Robinson and didn't know those particulars could come out of that film thinking he's a villain. So in that respect, it was negative, but in the fact that it told Dalton Trumbo's story, I thought was really good. And one other film that I really liked, also, I think biopics, you know, hit or miss, some usually a mixed bag. The Cat's Meow from 2001, yep. which was directed by Peter Bogdanovich. And I had mentioned earlier how sometimes biopics try to explore maybe something that is an unknown and yep. maybe try to create a fictional story just to kind of explain what might have happened. And in this case, it's about the mysterious death of Thomas Ince. Cary Elwes plays Thomas Ince. You have Marion Davies, who's played by Kirsten Dunst. You have William Randolph Hearst, who's played by Edward Herrmann. Eddie Izzard plays Charlie Chaplin. It's quite a great cast. And what's mm-hmm. fun about it is it's the film is in color, but everyone wears black and white, which is kind of like a nice call out to the 1920s. And yeah, so it basically explores what if he had been murdered? So what would have been the circumstances that led to it? It's not the best film, but I thought it was really enjoyable, especially if you're really into classic film history.
Yeah, I saw and enjoyed The Cat's Meow. I'm ashamed to say I haven't yet seen Trumbo, actually. So that's definitely my homework now, I think. I think what I was not worried about, but what I wondered about with Trumbo was, because it's such important, weighty subject matter, will the film be kind of preachy? But from what you're saying, it sounds like no, is that right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, it did explore his, you know, his early work, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his kids. So it doesn't completely focus on the Blacklist. And yeah, and it had like a political message, but it wasn't overbearing.
Cool. I just wanted to mention a couple of films. So we're talking here about films depicting real people, but I think you can also maybe include films that deal with the world of classic movies, but don't necessarily directly present real people. So the first one was one that's, you know, probably quite fresh in the minds for some listeners. So the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar was a recent one that I felt kind of had it both ways for the most part. I think it was a good film. It peeled back the kind of glossy veneer in some ways. It was kind of knowing, but it also offered some straightforward pleasures too. So, you know, you can read it has these singing cowboy scenes and a Gene Kelly-type sequence with Channing Tatum, and you can say they're kind of mocking and the parodies and whatnot, but I think you can also enjoy them for what they provide on a surface level too. And it also had a great sequence, had these great sequences where Ralph Fiennes' sophisticated film director trying to coach a good performance out of Alden Ehrenreich's character, which always cracked me up. So that's one I liked. Have you seen it, Raquel? Did you enjoy it or not?
I had a mixed experience with that. I did like the fact that everyone was a type of, like, you have an Esther Williams type, you have a Gene Kelly type. So I like that they did that and they kind of played with that. But yeah, I wanted to like it, but didn't like it as much as I did. Sorry.
No, that's all right. Like, so I think it was good rather than great. But the second film I'm going to mention, which sprang to mind, this is one I really want to revisit, actually. White Hunter Black Heart from 1990. Directed by Clint Eastwood, which is a fascinating film. It's a loosely disguised fictional story. It takes place during the filming of what effectively is the African Queen, John Huston's film. And Eastwood effectively is playing John Huston. So it's very interesting that you have someone so famous with such a well-defined star image as Eastwood in that role. And I just remember it being really strange because kind of like some of the things we've touched on about casting these roles and I don't know. It's not like Eastwood is just doing himself. He is stretching himself a bit. He does a bit of an accent and some different mannerisms and so on. So it's kind of jarring initially, but as I remember it, that kind of goes away after a certain point and you realise there is a substantial core to the story. I don't know, maybe it's more interesting if you're interested in Eastwood and his films, maybe it's more interesting than if you want to learn more about Houston or the African Queen. Because like I say, there is that kind of remove, this level of remove where it's different names and so on. But yeah.
Oh, I've never even heard of this film until you mentioned it.
Yeah. What about these films then when they don't really work? Because that can be interesting to kind of scrutinize and look at too, can't it? So yeah, can you think of one that really didn't hit the mark?
Well, in 1965, there were two dueling Jean Harlow biopics, both called Harlow. One starred Carol Baker and the other starred Carol Lynley. I've only seen the Carol Baker one, and I read this wonderful biography of Joseph Levine, who was a producer, and he produced this film, and he and his crew were running into all sorts of issues where the thing is, in 1965, a lot of people from Jean Harlow's life were still alive and still around and did not want their names associated with the film. And so they had to change so many aspects of her story, make up new characters, that it's complete fiction. But then you have a Jean Harlow character here. So it's over the top. It's very cheesy. But if you go into it thinking this is not like a legit biopic, this is just kind of a crazy movie, you might actually like it a little bit. But it's just an example of how a biopic can go wrong. And this one definitely went wrong. I have not seen the other movie with Carol Lynley, but from what I understand, it also ran into some of the same issues with people who didn't want to be associated with the film.
That's fascinating, though. I mean, I haven't seen either film, actually, but it's fascinating that they came out at around the same time.
Yeah, and I, from what I understand, the book is called Showman of the Screen, which is about Joseph Levine. I highly recommend that book. It goes into detail on how both productions were racing to get it finished and get it out in theaters first, and I think they kind of were neck and neck. So, yeah, it's just an unusual little bit of Hollywood history.
Now, I feel quite bad about the next one I'm going to say, because it stars one of your favourite actors, unfortunately. So, a film that never really came to life for me was The Last Tycoon from 1976, directed by Elia Kazan. So, a great cast. Robert De Niro in the lead. Jack Nicholson's in it. Tony Curtis. Robert Mitchum. And quite a few more, but I don't know. De Niro's playing like an Irving Thalberg-type figure. The film's based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's unfinished novel. So I'm not saying I hated this, I'm not saying it's a terrible film, but strangely kind of uninvolving, doesn't really come to life, but worth seeking out for the people involved, though. Yeah, so obviously, as I've alluded to, you're a huge Mitchum fan, as listeners will know, so sorry, Raquel.
Yeah, no, I actually have never seen that film, and it's kind of low on the list of priorities, yeah. So yeah. Good to know that it's worth, you know, not rushing to.
Yeah, no need to bump it up the list is my recommendation.
Okay, good.
Okay, so Stan and Ollie. Well, actually, no. Laurel and Hardy we should start with. So, I mean, I'm sure at some point we'll talk about them more on the podcast. I know I definitely want to do an episode on Sons of the Desert at some point. But, yeah, what's your general fondness for Laurel and Hardy? Would you class yourself as a fan of theirs?
I classify myself as a casual fan. Early on in, like, my classic film journey, I discovered Laurel and Hardy. I love comedy, so it was a natural progression just to watch their shorts and their feature films. And one thing is, a lot of people share a love of classic movies with their parents or their grandparents. Mm-hmm. They grew up watching classic movies as children. I did not have that experience. But one thing I did share with my father is his love of Laurel and Hardy. He grew up in Portugal in the 20s and 30s when Laurel and Hardy were huge. They were international sensations. And in Portugal, they were called O Bucha e Ostica, which means it's basically slang term for fat and skinny. So, yeah. And also that's the thing is, Laurel and Hardy were named different things depending on the country and the language. Mm-hmm. So That's one thing I could share with my dad, which was very special. So once I knew he was a fan of Laurel and Hardy, I sought out more of those movies. And what's cool, too, is when I first started my blog, the first post I had ever done was about Dick Cavett. And then 10 years later, I met him and I got to ask him about Stan Laurel. He met Stan Laurel in the early 60s when he was working on the Jack Parr show. And Stan Laurel, he told me like Stan Laurel was just in the phone book. He just showed up one day and they had a, you know, a nice meeting. And Dick Cavett also grew up watching the Laurel and Hardy films. So I think that's really cool. Like you can see the interview I had with Dick Cavett on my YouTube channel. That was a really cool experience meeting somebody who actually had met Stan Laurel. Mm. So those are like my kind of personal connections to Laurel and Hardy.
It's hard to imagine today's film stars just being in the phone book, isn't it?
Yeah, you know? Right?
Yeah, so I guess I would class myself as a casual fan too. I mean, I feel a great affection for Laurel and Hardy for a similar reason, like my granddad always used to talk about them and things like that. So it's been a while since I've seen any of their feature films, actually, but I like all the ones that everybody seems to like. You know, I love Sons of the Desert and Way Out West. And I remember happening across the Music Box short when I was watching TV when I was younger and just thinking, who are these guys? You know, this is really funny.
That's a great one.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
My favorite is Liberty, which is a silent short.
Ah.
Basically, they're trapped on this scaffolding of this building that's being constructed. They're really high up and they could fall over and one of them has a crab in his pants and it's just like, it's hard to describe. It's totally bonkers, but it just like the fact that I'm scared of heights and they're on these great heights and they're almost going to fall down is just hilarious for some reason.
No, yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen that one or not. I'll have to double check, but I just had a look this week on Amazon Prime in the UK. So I watched three shorts. I watched Bratz and Hogwild and one called The Laurel Hardy Murder Case, all from 1930.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't seen them before. At least I don't remember seeing them before. So, you know, it's good to know that they're still available to see quite easily. But I was just thinking back to my childhood and things, and I'm curious to hear about what this was like or what this is like stateside. But when I was younger, it was quite easy just to happen upon one of these films on TV. It just doesn't seem to happen anymore. And I can't help think it's a real shame, you know, because I think younger audiences would still love the humor in these films or, in, you know, somebody like Buster Keaton or somebody, if only they were exposed to it. And I know that those of us who love classic films will do our bit, we'll buy the box sets and mm-hmm. so on. Most people won't do that, understandably. And I don't know, I think there's something kind of heartbreaking about the idea of people like Laurel and Hardy not being passed on from generation to generation. So I don't know if I sound a bit of a grumpy old man or something saying that, but I think it's kind of sad. So I'm hoping that you're going to tell me their films are a bit more widely circulated in the US and still broadcast regularly and things like that. But yeah, what would you say?
Well, I don't know about where it's broadcast. I don't know. I'm sure TCM shows Laurel and Hardy films maybe once in a while, but I don't know about how it was circulated on TV. I'm pretty sure, like, you know, the Marx Brothers movies, Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, especially in the 80s, were probably on TV all the time. But one thing I did hear back from my fellow classic movie fans, especially those with kids, is they introduce Laurel and Hardy to their children and their children love it. So there are, at least in the classic film community, there is a movement to introduce some of the early comedians, you know, like Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, all of them to children, because that is very accessible. It's just there's so much fun to watch, and you can break down that barrier that people have of, oh, it's a black and white movie or it's an old movie, when you get them laughing. So I think there's a glimmer of hope for the future, and the fact that this biopic exists, Stan and Ollie, also maybe will help introduce, you know, kids to this in the future.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm glad you're more optimistic than I am. That's good.
Got to keep the hope, Carl.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think you're right, though, that there is something timeless about their comedy, you know, and I was trying to think, like, why that might be, and I don't know. I think they were just funny, and I know that's not great analysis, but they were. They were just funny to look at, you know, because of the physical mismatch.
Yes.
They were funny to listen to, and it's interesting that they bridge the transition from silent to sound with great aplomb, really. They got better in the sound era, most people would say. And they were just funny to watch together. They had great interpersonal chemistry in front of a camera or on stage. And it's fascinating that even though you hear they weren't always bosom buddies, and you hear that they're very different approaches to their work. You know, Laurel, more of a workaholic. Oliver Hardy liked playing golf and gambling and all this.
More fun-loving.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know any of that, would you, when you see them in front of a camera? They were right. Great together.
Yeah, they had a magic, and I think that is conveyed in the film, but also in just their work in general, and that's what draws us to them. And yeah. I think also the physical comedy. There's so much amazing physical comedy, and that never gets old, I really don't think. And that's also the appeal of like a Buster Keaton or a Harold Lloyd, is just seeing them just, you know, fall down or trip on something or some, you know, the fantastic skit they do with the song where Hardy hits Laurel over the head with a mallet and his voice changes pitch. You know, like that stuff is just... That is, like, forever funny. Like, that will never get old.
Okay, let's move on to Stan and Ollie, then, specifically, which I hadn't seen, actually, before I suggested we do this podcast. So it was kind of interesting. I was like, will I like it? I'm sure I'll like it, but what if I don't? But in short, I did, and I'll explain more why in a moment. But just wanted to read out a couple of listener comments, which were general takes on the film. So Lil Uzi Kurt said, I loved it. I've always been a fan of the duo. And it was just so great to see their friendship portrayed like it was. Great performances all around as well. And Chris Lajazar, I hope I pronounced that right, says, really good, funny yet sad, heartbreaking yet heartwarming. So, yeah, I thought this was a very charming film, Raquel. I think it manages to... It tells a story that's interesting for what it says about Laurel and Hardy, of course, but it goes beyond that, I think, and it touches on some themes that will resonate for viewers in other contexts, too. Yeah, the performances are very accomplished. I think it's quite a considerable achievement, really. I think they were both tasked with a difficult roles. It's a very sweet film, very sincere. So there's a bit of conflict, but I guess it's rather gentle for the most part. So nothing that's likely to offend anybody here. The kind of film you watch with a big smile on your face, I would suggest. But yeah, what's your general take?
So I have to say, maybe this is a little over the top, but this might be the best biopic I've ever seen. It's just... Wow. I know it's not completely 100% accurate to their story, but it really captures everything about them so beautifully. There's very little, I have to say, negative about this film. I think they just did a brilliant job in terms of the production quality, the performances, the attention to detail, the story that they chose to tell, the pacing of the plot I thought was really great, how they kind of show you, you know, the real Stan and Ollie and then the on-screen Stan and Ollie. I thought that was super interesting. And I just think overall it was so great and it left me in a puddle of tears at the end. I recently had to watch this again just to have it fresh in my mind for this recording, and I almost dreaded the ending because I know I was going to lose it emotionally, and I did. I just went through several tissues, and it's just, I love that it's powerful in that way, that you get the essence of Laurel and Hardy, you get to know them as people and as performers, but then it's just an emotionally powerful film, which I thought speaks a lot to it.
Yeah, I thought so too. I didn't cry myself, but, you know, almost. I think it was very moving, you know. And
I'm an emotional person.
Yeah. I mean, I do cry at films sometimes. I think maybe on repeat viewings, who knows? We'll see. But Annie Flowers sent us a message too, and she said, it was a sad but beautiful tribute to the duo. The acting was great, and I felt transported. I'm disappointed the movie didn't get more recognition. And I thought that was interesting that she mentioned that about recognition. Because, yes. Yeah, this film seemed to kind of come and go, didn't it? It didn't really get any Oscar race. It had some nominations at different award ceremonies, but not that many overall. And at the box office, I looked it up and it was about $5.5 million in the US. Mm-hmm. I think they tried to open it in a limited number of cinemas or theatres, as you'd say, and then expand. And it didn't seem to kind of take off in the way they must have hoped, but did much better in the UK, which is something, I suppose. But yeah, kind of sad it didn't do better, I suppose.
Well, one thing, too, is around the time that they announced all the Oscar contenders, before they announced the nominations, this film didn't even qualify for the Oscars. So...
Ah, okay.
I don't know if we can call it a snub per se if it didn't qualify. I think what happened was to qualify for the Oscars here, you have to have the film release within a specific time frame, and it has to screen in the Los Angeles area at a certain number of theaters X amount of times for it to be considered. And also, it needs to be submitted. So I don't know where it fell in that. I know it released in theaters here on a limited run in December of last year. Mm-hmm. So it might have just missed the mark. And it also, because it came out last year, it probably missed the mark for the next go round as well. So I think it was just maybe timing. And yeah, I was a little disappointed that maybe there wasn't more publicity for it. I do know that John C. Reilly was nominated for Golden Globe. So at least mm-hmm. there's that. But yeah, it would have been great. I think they both could have been Oscar contenders had it been a qualifying film.
Yeah, and I think it had a few BAFTA noms over here, so that okay. was nice. Yeah, so I guess one of the big things to discuss here is the decision to tell this particular story about Laurel and Hardy at this point in their lives and careers. So we had a message from somebody called Bones McKinney who said, the film looks really good, I'd rather see one about their heyday. And, well, it definitely is an interesting choice in terms of, like, structurally and so on. So the film starts with them at their kind of zenith, doesn't it, career-wise, mm-hmm. and then we skip forward to them at a much lower point. Why does it work as well as it does? Because it's not maybe the obvious choice of tale to tell about them.
Yeah, and I know what I didn't know when I had watched this the first time is it was based on a book that was written about their final kind of like final hurrah, their last tour together. And yes, I did think it was a curious choice to go with that story and not maybe go with their heyday. But it just seeing how like how this beautiful film came out and how like there's so much emotional resonance with it. And it comes from that story of it being their last hurrah and how much they love their work and how their careers are over and how their lives are winding down. And I think that's a story that maybe Hollywood is scared to tell because it is, you know, it is a very melancholy story. And also, you know, stories about older people, maybe not as popular as ones about younger people, but maybe a story about their heyday wouldn't have been that interesting. Maybe the story of their last hurrah is far more interesting than them meeting for the first time at Hal Roach Studios and becoming and developing their partnership. Maybe that story wasn't as interesting.
Yeah, maybe that wasn't as strong an angle, perhaps. And I think what they did works a treat. I mean, I can understand, though, why somebody would say that.
Yes, I do. I understand that, too.
Yeah, especially if you're a big fan of theirs. And on one level, it'd be nice to kind of share in their greatest triumphs with them. But I think this story really is dramatically compelling.
Yes.
I think the fact that they're past their prime, actually what it does, it generates a real sense of pathos, I think.
And, yes.
I was fascinated by what the screenwriter said, too, Jeff Pope. Because he kind of learned about this period in their lives and became fascinated by it. Apparently spent the better part of a decade like learning all he could about it. And he said, what I realized in doing the research is that I wasn't writing a biopic, says Pope. I was writing a love story.
It's a bromance.
Yeah. Yeah, because they say like all we had was each other, Laurel says at one point, and it's really true.
I have some tissues next to my microphone here, so.
I'm interested about what you said, though, about like older. You know, they're older at this point, and I think that really works in the film's favour too, because, you know, we get all this stuff, especially as the film moves on, don't we, about, like, Hardy's health and so on.
I think that's where a lot of the drama comes from. They have been in their careers for several decades, maybe at 30 years at this point, if they started in the 20s, and this is meeting them in the early 50s. So they're past their prime, but they still have this wonderfully devoted fan base who still remembers them, and they have this one opportunity to have this last hurrah. And the fact that they love their work, they love what they do. I mean, health issues and the issues with the industry getting funding for the film that never happened. Just the fact that they still love the work. And that's also something that, you know, elderly people struggle with. I mean, they're not technically elderly here, but they're getting older, and we're at the end of Oliver Hardy's life at this point. But one thing is, you know, when people retire, they lose their sense of purpose, and we see how important it is for people who are very passionate about their work, how that drives them, how that gives them a reason to live, and it fills them with happiness. And that's, I think that's maybe a more subtler message that comes across in this film. It's not the main point of it, but it's something that is conveyed.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that, like you say, it's maybe a little unfair to call them old, but they're getting there. And like you say, Hardy especially has only got a few years to live in chronological terms at this point. So it kind of fits in with that broader trend, I think. You get these films now that they give you these aging characters. So if we're thinking about that classic Hollywood movies. There was that film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, about an older Gloria Graham, for instance.
Yes.
But also more broadly, and like you were saying about older people trying to find a sense of purpose. So we have things like The Bucket List or The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel or The Intern. And I think I like it as a trend. It makes a nice counterpoint to the types of stories contemporary Hollywood has often like majored in, doesn't it? Films that really kind of fetishize youth.
And one great thing about it, which helps the industry as well, is that, you know, you have this wonderful pool of talent. They're getting older. It doesn't make sense for them to play people who are much younger. So to find these stories that suit them age-wise, I mean, Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly are both playing younger and older versions of Laurel and Hardy. But this is more age-appropriate, and it's wonderful material. So if anything, it's something to seek out more because, yeah, you could take advantage of these wonderful stars who are just getting older.
Yeah, and I think in the film where we see, like we say, there's this stuff about Hardy's health and his aging body and so on. And when you see towards the end of the film, that scene, it's great, isn't it? Where they perform their dance on stage.
Yes.
For what they know is going to be the last time. And I just think that's more emotionally involving.
Yeah.
Than it would have been in a story about their younger selves where we'd sit, maybe it works up to them doing the dance together for the first time. Do you know what I mean? I think the way they showed it here was kind of pitch perfect.
Yeah, because we know this is going to be a huge struggle for Oliver Hardy because of the age and his health condition. And the fact that we see him do that dance again at the end is we know this is a triumph for him. And this is him living his dream. And it's just, there's emotional weight that, like you don't get that in the early scene where you see them performing that for the first time when you're back in like the 1930s.
Definitely. So I wanted to talk a little about, you know, these performers specifically and like how successfully they bring these roles to life. And let me just read you a few comments which kind of touch on it. So Peyton James Ennis said, I love the film. It was so touching. Coogan and Reilly are so good. I forgot I was watching actors. A love letter to Laurel and Hardy. John, who's at correct_math on Twitter, said, I was sold by the two leads as soon as I saw the trailer. Both are understated in my opinion. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Wasn't exactly what I was expecting, but that's more than fine. And Dustin, who's at BookBabble on Twitter, said, I was super hesitant to watch it initially because I loved the duo and wasn't sure if they could pull it off, but they did a bang-up job. I love how real they made John C. Reilly's prosthetics look. And yeah, I'd heard a few people who were kind of not necessarily slamming the casting, but a bit kind of hesitant when it was announced. But I thought they both did a very fine job indeed. What did you make of the both of them? Because I suppose John C. Reilly has the more sort of transformative role, doesn't he? He kind of disappears into the role and has all these prosthetics and so on. I can imagine somebody not realizing who it is, actually.
I had to say, though, Steve Coogan also has prosthetics, which you can't tell. He has a nose prosthetic and ears. And I think they did something with his hairline, too. There's a little on the Blu-ray. There's a little featurette about their transformation. And it was interesting how they the John C. Reilly's transformation is obviously a lot more visually noticeable. Mm-hmm. But they also did quite a lot for Coogan. And I think I always notice prosthetics because sometimes they're overdone. I felt this was kind of seamless. Like, I just forgot that these were actors playing other people or that there was prosthetics and makeup and stuff. I forgot. I just kind of got lost in them. It looks very natural. So whoever the makeup team was behind this did a bang up job. And then they capture all those little nuances, the movements, the little mannerisms that both Laurel and Hardy had. It not only the mannerisms they had on screen, but some mannerisms maybe off screen too. Like you see Laurel doing that thing with like his head where he kind of scratches his head at the very top of his head. That's very characteristic of him on screen. But then you see Coogan transforms himself into the workaholic Stan Laurel. So you've got to get the seriousness, the focus on the work and the determination. You get that as well. John C. Reilly portrays Hardy as the fun, loving, you know, kind of, you know, he's just here because he really loves doing the work kind of guy. He does that very seamlessly. And one thing, too, which I really appreciated about how they set up the scenes is that there's a clear difference between the on-screen Laurel and Hardy and off-screen. But I like there are certain moments, for example, when they go to that hotel for the first time, yes. The small hotel, and then they're struggling with Laurel struggling with all the luggage. That is so characteristic of what they would have done in one of their movies, but they're portraying it as something that happened in real life. So I like that it shows that you can't really separate the performance from the performer, that they both put something of themselves into their performances. And that was just so subtle, but wonderful. I really love that.
Yeah. And my favorite scene in that vein is the scene later on where they share a bed together. Again, very kind of touching, because the screenwriter, Jeff Pope, said, "As a boy, it struck me as the most wonderful thing that when Laurel and Hardy stayed in a guest house, they shared a bed. What's better as a kid than having your best friend sleep over and pull the covers over your heads? Late in life, while on these tours, Laurel and Hardy became as close as they had been in their movies. So in Stan and Ollie, I got them back in bed together."
Yeah, this you get to appreciate the intimacy between them as friends, as a comedic team. But yeah, it's definitely a bromance. I felt that bromance part of it.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but I loved how it paired Shirley Henderson and Nina Arianda as the wives, how they're almost a comedic team themselves. They're opposite personalities. They're also opposite in terms of how they appear, because, you know, like Shirley Henderson's very petite and Nina Arianda's taller and very glamorous, and how they have like a funny repartee between them. They kind of clash, but they're also united in the same effort to support their husband. So I felt that also served the story very well.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, because they get some great individual moments, don't they?
Yes.
Like Ida's always talking about dancing for Preston Sturges, and Lucille's kind of like, yeah, we've heard all this before, that kind of thing.
There's a line that Shirley Henderson says because they were talking about how they want to make the Robin Hood movie. Oliver Hardy is very concerned about falling off the log into the river. So Ida's talking about how, you know, when she worked for Preston Sturges, she dealt like she injured her ankle or something and she kept dancing with the pain. And then Lucille later on says, introduces her as like, she's a dancer with a very high pain threshold. And that was such a great little, that's a great line. Just delivered kind of very slyly. And it was just a nice little comedic moment that I loved.
I also really like Rufus Jones, who plays the manager, Bernard Delphon. I really liked him because he's kind of like, he starts off all this kind of bad news about, oh yeah, maybe we'll truncate the tour and all this, but tries to kind of make it seem as if it's not his idea and that kind of thing. And he kind of wore it really lightly, I thought. But yeah, what did you make of him?
I really liked how he played the character. He's kind of worried about how this is going to go, but he also really has some affection for them. So he wants to see them succeed. And I like how he kind of drops the hint about doing a publicity tour, you know, like, oh yeah, yeah, you know, I know you guys don't want to do a publicity tour, but it might help. And then they have this amazing publicity tour, which just drums up all this attention for them and gets the theaters filled, and they get these bigger venues, and that's wonderful. The only thing I didn't understand about his character was where his intentions lied. Was he strictly business? Did he believe in them? Did he not believe in them? I felt that was maybe a little vague. I don't know. What do you think?
I got the sense that he just didn't really, not that he disliked them, but that he didn't appreciate them for what they were, at least at first. Yeah, so I don't think he was kind of callous about it, but I think he was one of these guys who kind of just moves with the times. So yeah, I think you're right that perhaps they could have maybe explored that a little more, but I thought the actor was really good.
Yes.
there's also something very poignant, like you say, about when they start this, the publicity tours and so on, and they're constantly reminded about their past glories, aren't they? And on one level, it's really nice, but it's always kind of couched in terms like, you know, I think it's great that you're still going. My parents love you.
There's lots of lines like that in the movie. Or that one scene where Stan Laurel is looking at the Abbott and Costello poster that gets me every time. It breaks my heart because they know that their time is ending and they're going to be replaced by this other comedic team, which is, breaks my heart. I mean, Abbott and Costello had been going for a while by that point, but still, just every time I see that, it breaks my heart.
Yeah, I suppose you also have people like Martin and Lewis at this point, who they don't mention in the film, but all these other younger comedians too. And the other scene I was thinking of is when they're at that party and they're introduced to kind of the upper class couple.
Yes.
And the guy says, well, my wife loves your films. I mean, I don't really watch them myself. And then it's that scene where they go on to have that argument, you know, where all these tensions come back to the surface. And that's the point, I think. I mean, I was enjoying the film, but at that point, I knew it really was working for me because they do this switch to kind of melodrama. And I was really invested. I just hated seeing them argue. You know, it's kind of, it's like, don't, guys.
Yeah, no, that whole scene, I mean, that scene has comedic elements leading up to it because, you know, this is kind of absurd what's going on in terms of their interactions with these people. But yeah, and then everyone around them, when they're actually having the argument, gets silent and is watching them have this argument. And then that moment at the end when that older couple was like, oh, is that supposed to be funny? You know, I was like, wow. I mean, I think there's a level of misunderstanding of who these people are within their world, which I think is interesting from the different characters. And one thing too, that Laurel says at the end of the film, when he's talking to his wife, that I thought was very poignant, was the fact that he mentions that in their movies, no one knows who they are. Oh, here it is. I wrote it down. When you watch our movies, nobody else in the stories knows us, and we don't know anybody either. It was just the two of us. All we had was each other, and it's just the way we wanted it. And I was like, oh my goodness, that is just a great way of describing their career, their films, and their friendship. It's just, that was very poignant.
Yeah, and it plays into all these things we kind of touched on about, you know, identity and the division between on stage, on screen, and off, and I don't know, I guess it kind of made me wonder, you know, to what degree do you need to know about Laurel and Hardy and, you know, their onstage personas? Is that essential to appreciate this film? Well, Sean sent me a message and he said, for me, tied with Apollo 11 for movie of the year, loved everything about it. You don't have to be a fan to get into this either. Have met several youngsters who had never heard of the duo and thought it was great. So would you go along with that? Do you think that anybody could watch this, conceivably somebody who's never heard of Laurel and Hardy, and get as much out of it as, let's say, we have?
I would have to say yes and no. I think as a story about two people at the end of their career, and in terms of the production quality, the sense of place, the sense of time, and really great performances, I think you can appreciate it as is, as like a piece of art on its own, for sure. But I think some of the nuances will be lost on people, some of the references. Like, for example, that elderly couple who was talking to them at that party, they mentioned the music box because the gentleman was like, oh, didn't you make that movie where like the piano falls down the stairs? Somebody who has no clue about Laurel and Hardy will completely miss that. And that's one of their most iconic films. So on a surface level, you can appreciate it as is. But if you're a Laurel and Hardy fan, there's a deeper and richer understanding and appreciation that somebody who doesn't know will not be able to access. So it's almost like there's two levels of access. And the access for people who know Laurel and Hardy is a lot better, in my opinion.
Yeah, like all the specific references will be unlocked. I think that's very fair. One thing that was nice for me is that three of us sat down to watch this film together. So me, my partner, and our son, who's 11. And we all enjoyed it hugely. And that doesn't happen all that often, actually, these days. Different tastes and things. You know, he likes his Marvel films and his Star Wars and things. You know, it's fair enough. But yeah, nice that the three of us all really like this film. And yeah, it's like what you say, I think. I don't think you need to be massively familiar with Laurel and Hardy to enjoy the film. I mean, some degree of familiarity will obviously help. But I think it could well be that somebody who has never heard of them would still get a lot out of the film. And I think it's because, like we said, the decision to tell this particular story, because I think the keynotes of the narrative, You know, it's about being past your prime, about being unappreciated. It's about physical decline, troubled friendship. I think those are all things that people will be able to relate to above and beyond the more specific trappings of the story.
I think that's fair. And also, if the film required a lot of knowledge of Laurel and Hardy, it would be a very weak film. And you'd have a very small audience. Yeah. So yeah, it does have to speak to multiple people. I'm just curious, what did your son have to say about it?
Well, he's quite monosyllabic, to be honest. But
good.
Yeah. Well, he just liked the performances, I think. He was chuckling at the hard-boiled eggs and nuts, that old routine.
Oh, yes. That's great.
Did you say that your... Did you say your husband saw this film, Raquel, with you, and was he not a big fan before, or?
He had never seen a Laurel and Hardy film. So the first time I saw this, I had received the Blu-ray, and so we were watching it at home together, and he said, oh, I don't think I've ever seen a Laurel and Hardy film. And I think I stopped the movie, showed him Liberty. We watched that and then went back to the film. And then he saw the film with me again when I watched it again for this episode. And he absolutely loved it. In fact, he actually wanted me to share some feedback, if you don't mind.
Go for it. Yeah.
He is a wardrobe specialist and he is very particular about how men dress. Like, he's very good at putting together outfits. He knows what looks good. He said whoever dressed Coogan and Riley knew what they were doing. Very well done. He pointed out that the tailoring, the fit of the costumes, and the color combinations were like top notch. So if anything, if you are a fashion nut, you know, and appreciate good fashion, that's another reason to watch the movie.
I think I might need some style advice from your husband at some point. Sounds really good. Yeah, no, I think I want to hear from any listeners who are listening. Do they know any more anecdotal stuff about this? People who've seen the film and maybe weren't as well versed in Laurel and Hardy, because I suspect that a lot of people will enjoy this film if only they get the opportunity to see it. So yeah, let us know, listeners. We've already talked earlier about like the factual record with biopics and things. Like, I don't know, it's kind of, I sort of take it on a case-by-case basis. If something feels authentic, I can forgive a filmmaker departing from the factual record. But I guess that will be different for each individual, won't it? I don't know. It's hard to know sometimes where to draw the line.
Yeah, it depends. Like, for example, that Trumbo film I mentioned earlier, the Edward G. Robinson, they wanted to add a villain. They wanted to make somebody a traitor in the story. And I think that maybe they had gone too far. Maybe it would have been worth creating a fictional character or taking somebody who maybe did something wrong during that era and using them instead. But if it's, you know, if it's a factual inaccuracy, but it works in terms of the overall story and capturing an essence, or at least driving home a point that is accurate in itself, then I think you can forgive it. It depends.
It depends. Yeah, I think a couple of listeners alluded to this. So Catherine, I'm going to say Lhota, LHOTA. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But she said, it was not completely accurate as a biography, but it was loving and the leading actors were brilliant. And I think you said, Raquel, you know, what wasn't accurate? Mm-hmm. And a guy called James L. Nybauer replied and said, for one thing, Stan was very supportive of Ollie doing Zenobia with Harry Langdon. He did not suffer sleepless nights, nor did it lead to tension between them. I guess they needed dramatic conflict. I thought the leads were terrific. And then I was doing a bit of digging and I found two articles that go a bit further into, you know, the film's departures from the factual record. And I think for the most part, these were all justifiable. So let's see what you think. So the first article I found was SmithsonianMag.com, written by a guy called Patrick Sawyer. What he says is this. So the film took 3 tours of the UK and condensed it into one. So a tour from 47, 52, and then a tour that spanned 1953 and 54. So what he says is, where Stan and Ollie deviates tends to be in service of dramatic momentum, namely the time and tour schedule crunch. But it is also neither a hagiography, nor does it make Laurel and Hardy's relationship more toxic than it was. So yeah, kind of condensing the time frame a bit, I think that is justifiable. I don't think it necessarily would have been a good idea to explain it a bit more, but I think you could maybe argue it the other way. I don't know.
I agree. I think biopics do this all the time. They shift the timeline so it fits into that movie mold. And honestly, if we had been watching them on several tours with breaks, it kind of would get boring and long. I think it makes sense for them to condense it so you have this one one tour in this one movie, because otherwise, yeah, it could have gotten a little messy kind of going into those extra details that maybe weren't necessary.
Yeah, you might need some clumsy exposition or something like that.
Yeah, and as Hitchcock says, filmic time is not the same as real time. Like, it doesn't... Yeah. Just because it's in the movie doesn't mean it could actually happen in real life.
Yeah, and Hitchcock said something as well about directors should... Something about they should judge the length of their movie by the endurance of the human bladder or something.
Oh, and, there you go.
Yeah, well, Stan Ollie, nice 97-minute runtime, and it didn't feel, you know... It flew by, I felt like.
Yes. I think a 1.5-hour movie is like the perfect amount.
Okay, so Sawyer also goes on to say, in the middle of Stan and Ollie, there's a key scene of public conflict between Laurel and Hardy. At a celebration following a tour performance, the two men argue. Old grievances and mild resentments lead to Laurel throwing food at Hardy, which is applauded by partygoers mistaking it as a bit. It's an invented moment, but Pope found hints of tension in his research. So that's an interesting question. Oh. Like, if you have these hints of tension, is it then acceptable to turn it into an event in the film? Yeah, what do you think about that specific invention then?
I think their friendship and their partnership had to be threatened at one point in the story.
Yeah.
So it had to happen, because otherwise you wouldn't have it. It would just fall flat as a movie. We have to understand that this is a movie and real life doesn't necessarily fit into movie molds. So... Yes, maybe they didn't fight over Zenobia. Maybe that wasn't something that was tense, that created tension. But for the story, we needed to see their friendship threatened to appreciate when they do reconcile and get back together. Because that's something that goes back to deconstructionist theory. Is like, you have to understand the opposite of something to understand the existence of something. So you have, in order for us to really appreciate their friendship and partnership, we have to see it almost fall apart or fall apart and see it get put back together for us to be like, wow, that was very special.
Okay, so far, not too concerned by these changes, so that's good.
Yes. I love this film!
Yeah, well, I don't think these next two quotes will change your opinion either. Hopefully not, anyway. So, IrishTimes.com, article written by a guy called Stephen Dixon. He says, there is little sense in the movie that Stan was returning home and to theatres where he would have been well known not only from films, but in person from recent tours and much earlier appearances. So, kind of as we've said about the earlier tours. He says, there is a grain of truth and some emotional justification in portraying Laurel and Hardy as semi-forgotten has-beens, I suppose, but contemporary reports show that as Hollywood royalty, they were received rapturously by cheering crowds in austerity-stricken post-war Britain. Stan, in particular, had difficulty visiting his family because he was mobbed whenever he set foot outside his hotel. But I guess, I mean, he uses the phrase emotional justification, and I guess that's the key point, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he says there's a grain of truth. So that's what makes that permissible, in my view.
And you know what? They didn't, you know, one of the things that they're working towards is that Robin Hood movie that never gets made. I don't necessarily know if that is accurate, but I do know that they are not going to make another movie again. So even though they might have had a lot of recognition at the time, their movie careers are essentially over. So that in itself is accurate. So I can kind of allow that, because it's partly true and partly not true. That makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that does make sense. And it's kind of interesting as well that we see kind of a fictionalized excerpt from the Robin Hood movie. Wasn't it? That was an interesting little touch. Yeah.
I do like that they do that. One of the very few things I have to complain about this film is that there isn't enough about their 1937 career. Because it goes from 1937 to 1953. And I wish there was little more about 1937. Well, which goes back to the feedback that you had received about wanting more of their heyday. And I would like to have seen maybe some more conflict with Hal Roach, you know, was played by Danny Houston, who I think is fantastic. But, I mean, there's only so much you can fit into an hour and a half movie. And one thing, too, is that if they had gone in different directions, maybe it would have been a longer movie that wasn't as appealing or compelling.
Right. I'll read you this last quote from the Irish Times then. And there's a nice story at the end of this, too. So, in Stan and Ollie, he says, on the posters outside the sometimes tatty theatres, Only their names appear, giving an impression they were on stage during the whole show. In reality, they performed a 20-minute sketch topping vast bills that included stars of the day, such as Elsie and Doris Waters, budding comics like Harry Worth, and the usual assortment of singers, jugglers, acrobats, and animal acts. But the nice story is that, so Oliver Hardy at this point is, you know, is in poor health and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently at the end of every week, he would climb all the stairs to everybody's dressing room and he would get everybody else's autograph, which I thought was a nice little story, even though nominally he's, you know, the biggest star there, really, him and Stan Laurel. But yeah, I don't think they needed to explain that in any more detail than they did. I don't think that is a big black mark against the film.
Yeah, I feel like the film is strong enough that all the all that you're throwing at me, I'm still leaning towards loving it.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, I wasn't trying to stop you loving the film, definitely.
I appreciate the challenge though, Carl. I like this.
That's all I could find. So for the most part, if there are any more kind of egregious factual errors, I haven't come across them certainly. Mm-hmm. And I had to do a bit of digging to get that far.
And one thing I have to say that will maybe, for classic film people, they'll appreciate this, is Ron Hutchinson, who passed away earlier this year. He founded the Vitaphone Project. Huge Laurel and Hardy fan. Before he passed away, he watched this film and absolutely loved it and was mad that it wasn't an Oscar contender because he thought the performances were great. So I remember I was Facebook friends with him and he had done a little Facebook post about having seen the film with his wife and how much he loved it. So if anything, is like a seal of approval there for anyone who hasn't seen the film yet and is worried about it being representative of these people.
Ah, that's nice. I'll tell you what I was wondering about from specifically like your perspective. What did you make of like the film settings and like these UK locations? And I don't know, are you a complete outsider, Raquel? Have you been to the UK before?
Or? I have been. I've been to London. I've been to Bath, Brighton, and Cambridge. Nice. That's the extent of my one trip in 2003 during a heat wave to England. I had a blast there. It was great. I was curious. It spends very little time in Hollywood, but they're mostly in England, Scotland, and then the final scene takes them to Ireland, correct? Mm-hmm. So what did you think of the settings? Because you're more familiar with the settings than I am.
Actually, I felt there was kind of a double function, you know, in the sense that, and kind of a push-pull thing, because mm-hmm. obviously they play up the fact that these locations they first go to are very humdrum and provincial, you know, in a way that serves the story, you know, and yeah, it's a Britain that's rebuilding itself post-war, and they're in places like Newcastle and Hull, places that are not glamorous necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Although if you get back to the UK, I think that Newcastle's a nice party town, if you get a chance. But yeah, it just seems like, you know, obviously what they're trying to convey is these are not the types of places Hollywood stars should be. They're a long way away from London. And I think that definitely comes across. So for me, the kind of push-pull was that I actually felt a bit kind of nostalgic for some of these places. And obviously this is the 1950s, and listeners, I'm nowhere near that old. So I was born in the mid-1980s. But some of the things we see very much reminded me of my own childhood. So things like the red telephone boxes and these little seaside towns they go to, where they have these quaint little traditions like the bathing beauty contest and things. Those were things that hadn't completely disappeared in the late 80s and early 90s when I was growing up. So I imagine if I'm feeling that kind of nostalgia, people who are older than me who watch this film must be feeling that too, I think. So, yeah, I think the film did it in a way that you understood why it was kind of a come down for them, but it wasn't too condescending, if that makes sense.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to know that it was true to the setting. And I have to say, as somebody who loves period films and is very, very particular about clothing, cars, mm-hmm. And objects, designs, things like that, there's so much to enjoy if you're a vintage enthusiast. Just the costumes that they wore, even the costumes that the wives wear are just absolutely amazing. And the attention to detail, like the blue berets that they wear, or the Hardy's hotel room, the different touches and how they set up that room and how they decorated it. And there's the one scene too with Laurel and his wife, and they're in this beautiful bar and it's got like teal chairs and they're having a cocktail, or well, he can't have a cocktail, but she's having a cocktail for him. And just the visuals, it's amazing. Like if anybody loves mid-20th century aesthetics, whether it's clothing or decor, will absolutely like revel in those details because they put a lot of attention and detail, and they did a bang-up job, really, just putting all of that into the film. And it feels like it feels a little glamorous, but it also feels authentic, too.
Yeah, just one other aspect I wanted to mention really quickly is I think that, you know, it's a film that has a restrained kind of elegance, I think.
Yes, that's a good way to say it.
Yeah, it's not too showy. Like, and it's from the get-go because, you know, as the opening credits play, there are those red curtains that we see behind them. Although, is that quite interesting shot that kicks off the story, isn't there? That long, unbroken shot that kicks us off where Laurel and Hardy just completely at ease in this world. You know, we see them as they're chatting in the dressing room, and then we follow them out onto the back lot and so on. And it sets up a lot. You know, we hear about Hardy's gambling. We hear about this idea they're not paid enough. The bond between the pair is firmly established. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a fascinating way to start the film, because I think if it works, which I think it does, then, you know, we're kind of on the hook. We buy into these characters and these performances straight away. But if the actors they'd cast hadn't been that good, then that kind of scene would kind of brutally expose that. So I thought that was a kind of a, I don't know if risky is the word, but an interesting choice to start the film.
Yeah, and I have to say that shows, establishes their characters. You see Stan Laurel's a lot more serious than Oliver Hardy is. And one of them is flirting with some of the girls that are on the set. And then you kind of get all these aspects of like what's going on a Hollywood set. And then, yeah, you get the confrontation with Danny Houston's Hal Roach. So you know that there's some conflict here. But one thing, too, is that you realize how big of a pair of stars they were in this era. And that kind of sets the tone, and that you know what they have lost when you go to the future and you see them performing in this very, very small theater somewhere in England. And they are in this very small hotel, no bellboy. So, you know, you kind of get a sense of what they have lost, in a sense. Yeah, that long tracking shot, very well done. As you said, I kind of agree. It was risky, but they pulled it off beautifully.
But yeah, I guess final thoughts, Raquel. I think people should see it. If you haven't seen it, well worth searching out. You know, I imagine it'd be quite easy for people to track down if they want to go and watch it. But yeah, you know, any final thoughts?
I have to say, the ending is wonderful, and I don't want to necessarily spoil it, but there's like almost like a three act ending in a way. You have them reconciling in the hotel, and then you have them on the boat, and they're kind of discussing the movie that will never happen.
Yeah.
And then you have them arriving in Ireland for that part of their tour and being greeted by all these very loving fans who are just celebrating them being there. As each of those scenes progresses, I cried more and more and more. By the end, I was a sobbing mess. It just, I love how that emotional buildup happens. I have to say, like, if anything, that is just one of the most beautiful ways to end a film. If anything, watch it for that beautiful emotional ending.
Yeah, have the tissues ready, guys.
Yes.
You'll need them, I think. All right, so we're going to wrap up, Raquel, but what I thought we'd do, so hopefully soon we're going to be talking about a few books, aren't we? So I thought I might just flag those up in case people wanted to get a head start on reading them. So we've been busy, haven't we? We've been reading a few things. We've read Dynamic Dames by Sloane DeForest. Mm-hmm. And people will have heard her talk to me on a podcast recently.
It's a great episode. I highly recommend it to anybody who hasn't listened to it yet.
Yeah, she was a pleasure to talk to. She really was. So yeah, if people haven't heard that interview yet, just a few episodes ago, so go and check it out. We've also had a look at Hollywood Black by Donald Bogle and Forbidden Hollywood by Mark A. Vieira. So without getting into the specifics, because we're going to talk about it at length, of course, but there's going to be plenty for us to kind of chew over with those titles, I think, isn't there?
Yes, I'm super excited. I love talking about classic film books, and we got really lucky with three amazing books released kind of around the same time, so it'll be fun to talk about all of them.
And yeah, but Raquel, I mean, a pleasure as always. Always great to talk to you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you're not following Raquel already, what is wrong with you, first of all? But never mind, because Raquel's going to tell you where you can find her online.
If you love classic movies, I have a blog, outofthepastblog.com. It has a matching YouTube channel where I also talk about books and old movie stuff. It's also called Out of the Past. And I'm on Instagram at Kel Movies, and I'm on Twitter, just my name, at Raquel Stetcher. And I love hearing from fellow classic movie fans.
Yeah. So if you do watch Stan and Ollie, listeners, let us know what you made of it. The podcast, The Movie Palace, is in all the usual places. So search for Movie Palace online, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. At Movie Palace Pod on Twitter is the place where I'm most active. But that's all for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. CarlSweeney. Thank you.